We've been working with some ethical things, and we really started out with, I guess, what, you know, we kind of think of the ethical issues, you know, euthanasia, suicide, you know, medical treatment. And I just kind of wanted to cap it with a couple of larger perspectives, one on the way we conduct ourselves individually, and then I just wanted to conclude with kind of a ethical considerations for the public services or for our corporate worship. And so, you know, this is just kind of introductory stuff. Debates about worship, there's nothing new about some of the ongoing debates about worship styles and the way of thinking about the church and how we would, you know, assemble and gather. That is not new. Many of them, and should become as no surprise, most of them have revolved around some element of music. So in the Middle Ages, there were lots of debates, for instance, just about the use of any musical instruments. This was something that Calvin wrote about extensively. I appreciate Calvin's work. I don't understand the logic. The logic was that instruments were okay in the Old Testament worship style, but they shouldn't be used in the New Testament. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it and getting into it, but in every worship leader, and by that I would mean pastor or whoever is assigned that responsibility, has to at some level interact with what we call the regulative principle, which really deals with what is permitted to us in worship. Are we confined only to things that the Bible mandates, or are we excluded only from things that the Bible condemns? And so there's a lot of debate about that. Charles Spurgeon, who was certainly one of the greatest Baptists in world history, died in 1892. They did not use instruments in their church services. And he had 5,000 or 10,000, I don't remember what it is, I think 5,000 seat Metropolitan Tabernacle that they filled every service. In fact, periodically, like once a quarter, Spurgeon would say to his church members, please don't come to church next Sunday night. We just want unbelievers to be able to find room to sit. And so that was kind of a different, but they didn't use instruments. He didn't do that. Again, going back to the regulative principle, there have been debates about using only inspired music. There are even today churches that will sing only inspired songs. In other words, they sing from the Psalms. They might sing from like Exodus 15, but the stuff that we use, they would not touch. And again, I have some, you know, I can appreciate where they're trying to be. I think it's ludicrous, quite honestly, to go to that extreme. But you can find some incredibly conservative Presbyterians, and this would be the way that they would view the church, and they would argue for it adamantly, right? That we can only do what God says. And since God did not say in the New Testament that we had permission to write our own music, we can only sing music that he wrote. And one of the problems, one of the problems that I have with that is that they have no problem with the pastor reading an inspired text and preaching a sermon from it. But if I took an inspired text and wrote a song from it, they would not allow that. And I just think that's a great inconsistency. They don't preach only inspired texts. I mean, they don't preach only, they don't just say, the only sermons we're going to preach are the sermons that we find Jesus preaching or Paul preaching. But that's the way they would treat music. Anyway, that's just me. In the 19th century, there were debates about whether or not to have a choir. And then there were debates about where the choir should be. And if you've come from a liturgical background or you pay attention in some more liturgical churches, they don't put the choir facing the congregation. They may put the choir behind the congregation or off to the side so that the choir is not the attention getter. This is kind of the logic there. We're going to have the music, but we don't want that to be the primary thing. So, you know, and obviously for us to put the choir off to the side would be a great challenge in a lot of ways. The gospel songs of the 19th century, many of which we still sing, and we sang a bunch of them in the old hymnal, were, folks, and we just never want to forget, whatever we're going to make of it, that's another issue. But I don't want us ever to forget that that music that we cling to and love as the best music was the contemporary music of its day. It was radical. It was controversial. It was rejected by the uber conservatives and guys like Moody and Sunday, who went around and had these song leaders, and they played kind of like an accordion thing, and they led their music that way and had these rousing gospel songs. That was held in utter contempt by the uber conservative guys. It's going to wreck the church. It's ungodly. It's anti-Christian. We don't do it. Now we hold it up and go, this is the good stuff. And if we don't, if we can't maintain that sense of continuity, we do that, I would really argue, to our own detriment. So it seems to me that there's always, right, as a church, and I mean, you know, here we are in Omaha, Nebraska, and there are, what, dozens of different denominational stripes. There are hundreds of churches, right? There are some that would be way out to the theologically liberal end. There would be some way out to the theologically conservative end. There are churches with blended services. There are contemporary services. There's whatever we are. There, and everybody is kind of making the same argument and responding to some form of this basic question. And that is this: how much it is new or trendy, or depending upon your perspective, worldly, can be used by the church in its public worship services. How much of that can we bring in? And, you know, I think that we really kind of want to be careful in how we broach this question, right? I mean, the Bible condemns worldliness, but the Bible does not condemn the use of things that are in the world. And I want to try and be thoughtful, and of course, like everybody else, I want to try and be biblical about this in the way that I would approach it. But a piano can be as abused as any other musical instrument, right? So the issue is not the virtue of the instrument. The issue is the use of the instrument. I think that it is a challenge for human beings to maintain the right attitude. But we are to be, on the one hand, always respectful of God. He is always God. But on the other hand, the Old Testament in particular is very clear that exuberant rejoicing is the right attitude, that it is possible to be happy and exuberant and noisy and respectful. And so we don't have the right to go, one comes at the expense of the other, because biblically it does not. And we will see that here. It's probably going to be the 1st of July before Nehemiah actually deals with that very thing. Nehemiah will tackle that very subject in Nehemiah chapter 7 and chapter 8. So how much it is new or trendy or worldly or contemporary can be used by the church in its public worship services. All right, so... and let me ask you, if you would please, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And I just want to, and we're going to do this really quickly, because I got probably a lot more material. I mean, we could give a lot of time to this. All right, so I just kind of want to back away from some of that. I mean, before we, you know, because it seems like almost immediately we start talking about, so should we just have a song leader or should we have a worship team? Can we use a guitar? Do we have to use a piano? Can we sing Keith and Kristen Getty music, or can't we? And you know, when we're down at that level, we're not at the Bible level. We haven't. So let's deal with the Bible level first, and then we can come up with answers to those questions. Right? We want to remember three key concepts about church ministry from 1 Corinthians chapter 3. So let me get 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Okay, and again, I'm just going to deal with this really rather quickly. All right, so Paul had started, just a little context. Paul had gone to Corinth and had started the church at Corinth. And then, of course, as God had for him, he went somewhere else and went on to other things. Evidently, and we're kind of reading to some extent between the lines, right? Evidently, there arise within the church at Corinth these people, their commentators tend to call them the super apostles. These group of leaders who come in and go, yep, that was what you did, Paul, but we do it better. And we have a better way now, and we appreciate what you did to get us going, but we don't need you any longer. We've got our own way of doing things now. And Paul then, all throughout the book, the First Corinthians, is kind of combating this idea. And so, right, this is where you get into this idea of carnality. Paul here is not trying to establish a category, which I think I would reject, this category that there is this carnal Christian floating around out there. Okay, which tends to be the way a lot of people view it, that you have saved people who are really got it right, and you have lost people, and then you have saved people who live like the devil, but they're really saved, they're just carnal. That's not what Paul is talking about. I would argue that person doesn't really exist, and Paul is not fighting against that here. So, all right, so three key concepts. Concept number one, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse number 5 through 9. Who then is Paul? Who is Apollos, but ministers by whom he believed, even as the Lord gave to every man. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are laborers together with God. Ye are God's husbandry. Ye are God's building. And so, broad principle number one from here, okay? Jesus is the master and men are not. Jesus is the master. I would just make this argument to you folks, and I don't believe that fundamentalism is exempt from it, okay? But I would say personally that the biggest problem with the contemporary church movement that we see today is not that they use music that we don't like. It is that they start from the position that the methodology of the church is flawed. And anybody that starts from the position that the methodology of the church is up for discussion is doomed from the beginning. Because Christ is the master and men are not. What's Paul? That's a great question. What's Paul? What's Apollos? I mean, where do these guys fit in this world of the church? Right? We are mesmerized by this notion of gurus. I mean, I don't mean you. I mean within my calling. Right? We fill our library shelves with how-to books, methodology books, philosophy books, what the church needs to do, what the church needs to be. Okay, Paul here is arguing to a church in which he is engaged in a conflict over the wisdom of the world in the use of the church has a place. And his first point is this: Jesus is the master. Men are not the master. I'm not the master. What am I? I'm just the guy who came in. I'm just the conduit. I'm just the water pipe. Jesus is the water. I'm just the messenger. Jesus is the master. Secondly, Christ is the master. Methodology is not. Verses 10 through 15. According to the grace of God which is given unto me as a wise master builder. Now remember, folks, if you go back and you start reading in chapter 1, right, Paul is not very long before he's talking about this concept of wisdom and the foolishness of preaching and the wisdom of the world. Right? Because the Corinthians were all about what we would. I mean, I don't think they thought this way. So I'm reading Beckham. They were all about doing the demographic studies. They were all about finding out what people liked and what people wanted. And they were all about finding out what resonated with people. And then they were all about making a church look like that to get at people. And here's Paul's position. As a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another buildeth thereon. And that foundation is the church. Another build thereon, but let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build upon this foundation, gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest. And I don't think, folks, that you should try to come up with a sermon or a Sunday school lesson or a devotional guide about what the gold of Christianity is and the silver of Christianity is and the hay. But the point is this. What will withstand the judgment of fire? This is what Paul is concerned with. Right? There's one foundation. It's Jesus Christ. There's one methodology. It's the methodology that he gave. And there are all of these workers throughout all time and throughout all of history and in every place working. And every man, look, folks, okay? I mean, whatever the church is, let's just confine it right here to Omaha, Nebraska. Every minister who names the name of Christ, everyone, the Roman Catholic priest, the Lutheran priest, the fundamental Baptist pastor, the evangelical pastor, the contemporary pastor, the Presbyterian pastor, every one of us is going to have the work of our life run through the fire. Every one of us. And the only thing that counts is whether that work can withstand the burning of God's judgment. That's the only thing that counts. So, it just seems to me, and I'm not trying to be hard about this or obstinate or unreasonable about this, but folks, you just have got to understand that I spend very little time trying to figure out what to do around Westwood Heights to make people like Westwood Heights Baptist Church. You're not the ones holding the flame. You're just not the ones with the flame in your hand. Take heed how you build. Take heed how you build. This is what Paul writes to the church that he established. Verse 14, if any man's work abide which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire. So everything burns, right? And Paul is here presenting a scenario in which the pastor himself is saved. And his life's work is ruined. So, the advice is, take heed how you build. So, all right. So, I would argue, and I think probably most guys are, even though the guys that disagree, right? We're going to approach this rather seriously and not rather casually. These kinds of things, you know, that you got to, you know, I don't want to just be a tradition-bound guy because that's the way we've always done it, because there's a danger in that we'll get to. But neither do I want to be a shoot-from-the-hip kind of guy. Okay? Number 3, verses 16 through 18, right? So Christ is the master, men are not. Christ is the master, methodology is not. Right, because here's what happens, folks. Okay, and I'm just talking to you now. I'm kind of talking to you as a pastor would talk with a bunch of other pastors, right? So we try to find out the biblical methodology, and we go, okay, here's what we're going to do. And then we go, this isn't working very well. People are not responding. And then we go, how do we get people to respond? That's what happens. How do we get people to respond? And when we start asking that question, the reality is that what gets one generation to respond does not get the next generation to respond. so that you can just chase through. I mean, you can chase through the last 30 or 40 years of major significant movements within professing evangelicalism, all of which have been geared around people will respond to this. They will be more inclined to think about things spiritually when we do if we do it this way. So critical concept number three, Christ is the master and men had better take this seriously. Know ye not that ye are the temple of God? Why would he ask that there? Know ye not that you're the temple of God? You're a local church, Corinth, and the temple of God, the dwelling place of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you. All right, so, okay, cool. Yeah, but now we've kind of gone into some Old Testament ideology here. If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. For the temple of God is holy, which temple ye are. And I just want to read verse 18, folks, to help you understand that the context is very clear here. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in this world, let him become a fool that he may be wise. And again, the whole context here is, let's do church. Let's do church. Let's survey Corinth and find out what will get people. And let's bring in, right? Because this is where we learned that Paul's really not all that much when he's in the pulpit, and he's not all that much to look at. I mean, and I'm really stretching it, right? But I mean, a guy who looks and sounds like Joel Osteen is going to be pretty easy on the ears and pretty easy on the eyes. So, all right, just a note here. The words defile and destroy in verse number 17 are the same exact word except for the tense of the verb. So, if any man defile, that is in the present tense, right? So if I, all right? So here's a pastoral admonition for me. All right, Largent, do you not know that this is the temple of God and that the Spirit dwells in it? If you defile it, God will destroy it. And the only difference there is, again, the future tense. If men will defile it now, God will defile it then. So, the mastery of Christ over the church has to be the most important consideration in how any group of people, air quotes, do church. And again, folks, there are people who have a variety of ways of doing it who are confident that God is going to be pleased with it. I'm not arguing with that. I'm not arguing with their position, and I'm not arguing that I'm knowledgeable enough to say that God is or God isn't. Just from my standpoint, this is where I am. First thing, what are we going to do in church? Who is audience number one? Oz Guinness advises to live your life for the audience of one with the eye of God in mind. Now, temple is holy. We're going to come back to that. Okay? Now, the New Testament does command churches, and for the sake of time, I don't think I'm going to have us read all of these. I'll just make note of them. I do not intend for it to be an exhaustive list. I try to confine the list primarily to things that we are commanded to do when we assemble together. Okay, Colossians 3:16, churches are to sing. When we meet together, the Lord expects us to sing. What instrument does he expect us to use? He did not say. He simply did not say. Do we need no song leader, one song leader, multiple song leaders? He did not say. What he did say is, I want you guys to sing. And when you pair it with Ephesians, I want you to sing psalms, and I want you to sing hymns, and I want you to sing spiritual songs. I want you to sing in your heart. I want you to sing to each other, and I want you to sing to me. That's what I want. So, we're the temple, and God takes that very seriously, and He is the master, and methodology can never be the master. Sing. Sing. That's what we have. Okay? Churches are to pray. When the church comes together, there is to be prayer. When I pray, you're supposed to be praying, not just listening. We pray. We break out now and pray together on Wednesday nights. Personally, I'm very happy for that. I think it has worked out fabulously well. Right? Churches are supposed to pray. The people are supposed to come together, and they are supposed to pray. And of course, those prayers are going to be governed by what the Bible. We're going to ask for things that we know we can ask God for. We're not going to ask God for sinful things. We're going to ask God for spiritual things. But this is what God says a church has to do. Churches have to come together and pray. Churches are to read the Bible. When Paul says, and turn, we can turn, I think, to 1 Timothy 4. First Timothy 4:13. First Timothy 4:13, till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. And that's Paul's not telling Timothy to make sure you have devotions until I show up. This is something he's commanding Timothy to do in the church. So we read the Bible. This is why we do it. This is why you bring a Bible. This is why I hope that you're following along. Turn in your Bibles too. Look at it. I heard a pastor say that when he looked down from the pulpit, what he wanted to see was his congregation's noses buried in the text of Scripture. That's what I want. Put your nose in the Bible. Right? Give attendance to reading. This is... How are we going to know what it is that Jesus likes? By reading what Jesus said. That's how we're going to know what Jesus likes. So we are to read the Bible. Churches are to preach the Bible. Till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. 2 Timothy 4:2, preach the word. Preach the word. So... And again, I don't want to, you know, that's not the primary intent here. But again, folks, and I mean, I'm going to do it this morning. I try and do it periodically, but I have come to the place in my life where my preferred method of dealing with the Bible is to pick a book and to work through that book systematically. And I know that sometimes people go, is that, you know, do we have to do that? Can we do anything else? Well, again, I'm just going to give you my perspective. Right? Jesus is the master and I am not. Jesus is the master and methodology is not. And I want to take that seriously. So I just, quite honestly, again, I'm not trying to be ugly. I'm not trying to be hard. I'm just much more concerned that Jesus is happy with my preaching than you are. I just don't know. I just don't know any other way to think about that. That the person who has to be the most pleased with the way I handle the pulpit is the Lord. And then, but again, we always come back to that, right? Because we know from the Bible, and I'm not, this is not any kind of self-imposed martyrdom because I don't mean it in that way at all, right? But we know when we do that, that tends to have a very much a winnowing effect, not a crowd-gathering effect, right? You can get a crowd when you feed them cheeseburgers and french fries, early part of John chapter 6. When you open the text of Scripture and go, I think that it's important that you be much more interested in the Bible than cheeseburgers and french fries, people begin to come up with their exit strategy. Now what? Now what? Right? If Westwood Heights is in numerical decline, now what do we do? And what we oftentimes mean is, now what do we change to remediate that? And there's only one answer, folks. If we were doing things right the first time, we don't change anything. We don't change anything. If we weren't doing something wrong the first time, why would we change anything? So, right? So churches are to preach the Bible. We are to sing. And when, and by the way, I'm right. You kudos to you because you do. And people comment on the singing. We are to pray. We are to read the Bible. We are to preach the Bible. We are to observe the Lord's Supper. And obviously, we're to baptize believers as people come to faith in Christ. This is a church ordinance. And there are all kinds of things that churches are to do. But these are the kind of things that churches are to do corporately. We are to minister to each other. And this is part of the way that we do it. In other words, you know, it's very easy for us to overlook the fact that the song service is mutual ministry. Say, I want to serve the Lord. What can I do? Sing more loud. Sing loudly. My English majors just cringe. Sing loudly. Sing enthusiastically. That's ministry. That's ministry. Okay? So I would argue, so we have three mandates and three things that I try to make sure that I never lose sight of, okay? And I would say to us who are conservative that we should be more concerned about more than just being conservative. I think it's up there on the screen. I would argue, folks, that we are as a church conservative by design. You know, we've been talking about spending a lot of money to upgrade the sound system and maybe to fluff up the auditorium a little bit. And so let me just kind of share my perspective on a little bit of that. I personally am more than willing and interested in doing whatever we can to keep the facilities as updated as we can without spending all of our money on the never-ending renovations. But I don't want, when we have guests, it doesn't bother me in the least for guests to think this is a conservative church and I don't want a conservative church, and for guests to go elsewhere. I can live with that. But I don't want to do anything to convey the idea that we're not a conservative church. We're just a dead church. And we stopped caring 50 years ago. We stopped caring how the buildings look. We stopped caring if we showed up. We stopped caring about anything. We just do what we've always done. We go through the motions. We come in. We do what we've always done, and we get out. That's what we want to avoid. Okay? We are conservative by design, folks. I am conservative by design. I have, okay, it's not accidental. It is deliberate, some of the things that I have resisted and rejected. I have not gone down the path of saying to you, we've got to change these things and these things because so many of our young people are not going to stay with us if we don't change them. What we have said is, this is what we are, and this is how we believe that we ought to worship the Lord, and there's nothing wrong with doing it this way. And we wish that everybody would worship with us, but they won't, and God bless them. But if we start going down the path of what do we got to change today, then we got to go down that path forever. So we are conservative by design. Revelation chapter 3. But folks, I would point out to you that just priding ourselves on being a conservative church is a bad thing. Revelation chapter 3. Verse number 1, unto the angel of the church in Sardis write, these things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know thy works, that thou hast a name that thou livest and are dead. So we need to be concerned about more than just being a conservative church. Sardis had a name that it was alive. That was its reputation. But that wasn't how Jesus thought of it. Jesus said, I know what everybody else thinks about you. They think Sardis is a living church. But let me tell you what I think about you. So here is divine counsel. Be watchful. Strengthen the things that remain, that are ready to die. For I have not found thy works perfect before God. Remember, therefore, how thou hast received and heard, and hold fast and repent. If therefore thou shalt not watch, I will come on thee as a thief, and thou shalt not know what hour I will come upon thee. Remember, because if anybody defiles the temple will Jesus destroy. Thus few names even in Sardis which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment. I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Now, right? So we don't want to just go, we do everything old, we use the King James Bible, and we just sing hymns, and we have piano and organ, and all's well, right? We're cool. Because that's not necessarily cool. So, Psalm number 97. I got 4 minutes. Paul said to the Corinthians, you're the temple. The temple is supposed to be holy. God is holy. And if you bring in all of your worldly wisdom into the assembly, in the pulpit and in the public leadership and in the methodology, that's not holy. That's not holy. So, Psalm number 9. Whoops. Psalm number 97. The Lord reigneth. Let the earth rejoice. Let the multitude of isles be glad thereof. Clouds and darkness are round about him. Righteousness and judgment are the habitation of his throne. A fire goeth before him and burneth up his enemies round about. His lightnings enlightened the world. The earth saw and trembled. The hills melted like wax at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the Lord of the whole earth. The heavens declare his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. Confounded be all they that serve graven images, that boast themselves of idols. Worship him, all ye gods. Zion heard and was glad, and the daughters of Judah rejoiced because of thy judgments, O Lord. For thou, Lord, art high above all the earth, for thou art exalted above all gods. Ye that love the Lord, hate evil. He preserveth the souls of his saints. He delivereth them out of the hand of the wicked. Light is sown for the righteous, and gladness for the upright in heart. Rejoice in the Lord, ye righteous, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness. This should be, I think, ultimately one of the main objectives of our coming together, is the production of holiness, apartness from sin, not stuck in a time warp, not stuck in a time warp, but separated from sin. Right, so when the psalmist is working through here, right, he is rejoicing because God rules. This is to him the best possible news. The Lord reigneth. Let the earth be glad. And as he works on through the psalm, he rejoices not only that God rules, but the way in which God rules. And lots of people, folks, and myself included at times, we all do this, we all chafe at the way God runs his world. But the psalmist here is rejoicing in the way God rules the world. To rule a world in righteousness is going to involve some things. And one of those is, verse number 10, a hatred for evil. Now, right? So this is where it becomes really critical, folks, that we think about this correctly. A piano is not necessarily virtuous, and a guitar is not necessarily evil. We need to hate evil because God tells us to hate evil, but we need to hate evil the way God hates it, what it is and why it is. And then we are in the pursuit of righteous conduct based upon the light of the Word and the holiness of God. So when we talk about, you know, what do we do and why do we do it? Okay, I just want to try always to articulate and always to articulate to you and always have it out there that it's not about just doing what we have always done. Because that really was, in many ways, right? That was something that the Pharisees tenaciously clung to. That we do it because we've always done this. We've got it established, and now it is our tradition, and we always do this. And Jesus wasn't at war with traditions. He was at war with the pride that their traditions had created. Right? I mean, Paul said to Timothy, keep the traditions that I've taught you. And Paul writes to the Corinthians, do everything decently in order, right? We don't, right? So, I mean, you know, because there are people like this. We don't want to become tradition bound. And so the answer to that is every service, every time is pandemonium and helter-skelter. And that way we're never bound to a tradition. Yeah, apart from the one that says we live in chaos. So, right, we're always kind of in this tension and this tightrope. We are conservative by design, but not in love, at least I'm not in love with a historical period of time as the epitome of the kingdom. The kingdom is yet future in its fulfillment, not past. So anyway, all right, so that's what I got. Questions, comments, critique?